You're listening to LawPod UK. It's a podcast that covers developments across all aspects of civil and public law in the United Kingdom. All the comments are current at the time of podcast publication. It's brought to you by the barristers at One Crown Office Row, and this edition is presented by Rosalind English.
It's been nearly 4 months since the United Kingdom left the European Union. In her latest episode of 2903 CB, which was recorded exactly 100 days since Brexit, Professor Catherine Barnard of Cambridge University looks back on this period, and journalist Bonnie Soames asks Catherine for her verdict on the way things have played out in the months since the withdrawal date.
Well, it's better than we thought it was going to be, because what we really feared was that we would leave with no trade deal. And this really would have been a disaster. The very fact that there is a trade deal, that the two sides are still talking to each other and that trade is still taking place, albeit less than had been the case before, is, of course, a testimony to the fact that things are at least functioning.
Functioning, and some might say that in terms of the UK economy, the dire forecasts of chaos at our borders haven't come to pass, even though we've also got the COVID-19 pandemic going on as well. But people say the IMF has revised up the forecast for the British economy this year. Do you think perhaps the doomsdayers in terms of Brexit got it wrong?
I think that's probably right, but I think there's a couple of important points to note. First of all, we do have a trade deal. It's a zero quota trade deal. And of course, a lot of the worst case scenarios was based on the fact that there would be no trade deal at all. That hasn't come to pass. Secondly, of course, we've got COVID, and the COVID effect has been quite dramatic, not just in terms of deaths, but also in terms of the effect on the economy. And what's very difficult to disentangle is the COVID effect from the Brexit effect. What we do know is that the economy is likely to bounce back as normal life begins to resume, but the long-term effects of Brexit will be ongoing.
Sugar rush.
Yeah, absolutely, for post-COVID. But what we just don't know is how serious the Brexit effects will be, whether it will be just teething trouble, as the government keeps arguing, or whether, for particularly small businesses, the effect of Brexit is terminal. And we've already seen that in respect of the fishing industry. We know how badly they've suffered. And of course, for them, they were strong leavers and they'd been promised the sun, the moon and the stars. And what they've got is a huge amount of paperwork, which has made it very difficult to export their goods to the markets that need them quickly and freshly.
And of course, when we say a sugar rush, basically COVID-19 has allowed the Chancellor, Rishi Sunak, to pump money into the economy to protect jobs and protect businesses like never before. So it's very difficult to tell what even the medium-term and long-term impact of Brexit will be on the economy.
That's absolutely right. And of course, not only was it right that he did that, because of course we need to keep the economy going, but in so doing, he's also stolen the Labour Party's clothes, because it's a high-spend Conservative Chancellor, which means that for Labour, it's very difficult to find a good landing zone. And what will they argue come the elections in May, these very important local elections?
One area that has caused problems, people have talked about a lot of Europeans being homeless on the streets during the COVID-19 pandemic because they haven't got the proper paperwork, immigration, so-called EU settled status, which has to be applied for. Now, you've written papers on that, haven't you?
So EU settled status, you're right, it's got to be applied for by the 30th of June 2021. And already 5.4 million people have applied for settled status. So at one level, this is an absolute triumph for the government. One that they're not trumpeting, because of course it shows that there were many more EU nationals living in the UK than the government had ever thought. The government thought it was somewhere in the region of 3 million. So the very fact that there's already 5.4 million have applied is quite remarkable. And for those who have good computer skills, who have good English, it takes very little time to apply for settled status. Indeed, the government says it takes the time it would take to make a cup of tea, and that's pretty much the case. unless you happen to be low-skilled, have next to no English, and you don't have a smartphone. And suddenly applying for settled status becomes much more difficult, even more difficult if you're a child in care and the local authority hasn't applied on your behalf. Now, it looks like there may be a bit of wriggle room there. It may be that children, they will be allowed to apply up until they're 18. But the other group that there's a lot of worry about are those elderly people who've got dementia, and they just don't know, they haven't applied. And then, of course, what we don't know is what the consequences are of not having settled status. The formal position is that these individuals are at risk of deportation. Now, trying to deport an elderly lady with dementia because she hasn't applied for settled status will not be a good look. But, of course, the first time she knows that she hasn't got the relevant paperwork is when she's refused help at a hospital or refused housing benefit. And that's when we start to see the really difficult stories, which were likely to come about in the summer and into the autumn.
And migrant workers who may have been furloughed because of Brexit, who would be on zero-hour contracts, getting COVID, perhaps going back and finding their jobs have been taken, are not entitled to any benefits. They haven't got the right paperwork.
That's the problem. And some of them haven't even got a national insurance number. And because national insurance numbers weren't being given out at the height of the pandemic, and then they're not going to get the £500 payment that the government is offering to low-paid workers who can't work because they're meant to be in self-isolation. So there is an awful lot of chicken and eggery going on here, and it makes life very difficult for these individuals. But one of the things we are learning is that sick pay is absolutely crucial for people who are in these low-paid jobs, because without sick pay, they carry on working and they carry on spreading the virus.
If we now look at some issues regarding perhaps Freeport, things that Boris Johnson's government trumpet as having been a big success, there's a lot of trumpeting and fanfare going on, or cakeism, if you like, that we've left the EU, but we can still have our cake and have Freeport, and this will be good for business. But it's not necessarily.
So Freeports are, you're absolutely right, trumpeted as being one of the dividends of Brexit. Now, this is legally not correct. There are about 80 Freeports in the EU already. And so you can have a Freeport when you're in the EU. And indeed, the UK had a number of Freeports up until 2012 when the legislation expired. And it was never clear why that legislation was not renewed. So these Freeports, it's Rishi Sunak's big idea. It's a way of saying to those left behind communities, look, this is a dividend from Brexit, who actually are not related. But what you're seeing with these so-called Freeports is, in essence, they are Freeports on steroids. They are really Freeports mixed with enterprise zones. And the UK has long had enterprise zones. Look at what's happened in London, for example, where the enterprise zones have been used to try and regenerate areas of considerable neglect. The big concern about Freeports and the legislation is going through Parliament at the moment in the finance bill, is that it's trade diversionary. And if you think about it, Harwich and Felixstowe have got Freeport status, and there'll be significant tax benefits for businesses setting up in and around Harwich and Felixstowe. If you're Great Yarmouth, not that far around the coast, you're going to lose, because why would a business set up in Great Yarmouth when they can get significant tax benefits about being based in a Freeport? And then the million-dollar question is, if the tax benefits are not good across the country as a whole, why are you prioritising certain areas and giving them tax breaks and not extending them to the country as a whole?
So robbing Peter to pay Paul,
exactly.
In effect.
Yes, absolutely.
If we turn to our more immediate needs, we're ending lockdown completely on Monday, but it's going to be a phased end of lockdown, and who knows when we'll all be able to meet normally again, normally in brackets. But mobility, our ability to travel, regardless of the travel corridor or travel passports, will Brexiting impact, putting COVID to one side, our ability to travel?
It will. We have lost free movement rights. And remember, that was one of the things that Priti Patel was so anxious to remind the public of the benefits of Brexit. But in fact, the public may discover it's less attractive than would first appear. So, for example, it is possible to travel, absolutely, but you can only travel to the EU for 90 days out of 180. So people who are looking to spend their retirement in the sun in the south of Spain will only be able to go there for 3 months, so, for example, from October to December, and they can't come back until April because they can only do 90 days out of 180. A bigger problem, in fact, will be for businesses. If businesses want to send their people to work in another EU state, it's suddenly going to become a whole lot harder. The rules are highly technical, but to put it crudely, you have to fall into certain categories. For example, you've got to be a short-term business visitor, or you've got to be a contract service, a supplier, or an independent professional. And then within those categories, you've got to tick a number of boxes, for example, have a number of years of experience, and only then can you work for a limited period of time under the provisions of the Trade and Cooperation Agreement. If you don't satisfy those criteria, you have to do it under domestic immigration law, which is extremely restrictive because, like UK law, lots of countries do not want to have foreigners coming in to take jobs which could be done by nationals.
And we're already seeing businesses setting up headquarters abroad to get round these types of problems post-Brexit, and particularly finance. We haven't covered that yet. We've done perhaps all the form filling that small businesses have to do, but finance is a problem.
That's right, and we've seen a large number of companies already move their activities, particularly to Amsterdam, but Dublin as well. It's partly because of the criteria about establishment, but it's partly also about mobility of people. And what you'll see is that this will carry on. The workarounds that companies have tried to use to stay in London just are becoming too onerous, and it's easier to go and set up shop in Dublin or in Amsterdam.
So we're saying things aren't as bad for the UK economy post-Brexit 100 days as the doomsdayers had forecast, but we don't really know because of the impact of the Chancellor pumping money into the UK economy post-Brexit. But it could just be that jobs are being lost, perhaps in a hidden way in the economy, because we're not seeing them because of COVID.
I think that's right. I think the COVID effect is masking quite a lot of change. And because it's smaller companies, less well-known names are moving, therefore they're not getting the coverage. And what's really quite remarkable, if you look at the newspaper coverage, you will see The Guardian and the Financial Times reporting quite carefully on what's happening in the post-Brexit world. But the other newspapers are really not that interested. And there is, and of course, this is very convenient for the government because it's very easy to say, well, most of it's COVID, it will get better, and there's nothing to see here, let's move along. Unless you happen to be a seafood company, when the effect of Brexit has been pretty devastating.
Moving on now to Northern Ireland, which dominates the news today, 100 days after the UK left the EU. But people said that the EU Trade and Cooperation Agreement, with its compromise over the Irish Sea and the border, would lead to troubles again in Northern Ireland. Are you saddened that it has?
Deeply saddened, but I'm afraid it was almost inevitable. And this is something we've been discussing on this podcast for months and months, because it was a compromise in the withdrawal agreement, not even in the Trade and Cooperation Agreement, the withdrawal agreement. There was a choice, and the choice stemmed from the implications of the Good Friday Agreement, the Belfast Agreement of 1998, which is 23 years old this weekend. And the Good Friday Agreement essentially said there would be no hard border on the island of Ireland. And this was facilitated by a remarkable sleight of hand, but essentially made easier by both the United Kingdom and the Republic being in the single market. The moment the UK left the single market, that meant Ireland was the outer perimeter, the outer edge of the European Union, and there needed to be a way for the EU to ensure that only goods that complied with EU standards would be able to get onto the single market. So the question then is, where do you have the border? Do you have the border between the north and the south of Ireland? Answer no, because that was incompatible with the Good Friday Agreement. So the alternative alternative, instead of having a north-south border, is to have an east-west border. And that would mean essentially a border down the Irish Sea, and that, of course, would essentially put Northern Ireland outside of the territory of the United Kingdom. Now, Theresa May said she would never have that, and indeed Boris Johnson said he would never have that, but that's the effect of what his version of the Northern Ireland Protocol delivered. Now, despite all of his statements that there would be no border down the Irish Sea and you could throw customs declarations in the bin...
That clip has played a lot on the news absolutely. This week, isn't it, with him facing people in Northern Ireland saying that.
In fact, of course, that is the reality of having a border down the Irish Sea, because Northern Ireland has a foot in both camps. It's part of the UK customs territory, but more importantly for these purposes, it's now also part of the EU customs territory. That means that the EU's customs code applies, and that means that goods going from GB into Northern Ireland have got to satisfy EU customs formalities. That is bits of paper.
But the missiles being thrown in Northern Ireland, people are saying it is about youth and deprivation. But the unionists, now that people are have a reason, or if you like, even an excuse to find difference, that really is rocking the boat in Northern Ireland.
This is absolutely right. And yes, there are a number of reasons why the unionists are out on the street. But what they have learnt is two things. One, they saw that there would be no border between the north and the south, because that would upset the nationalists and there would be violence as a result. And so one of their responses is, well, if we're violent, therefore we can get what we want, and we want no border down the Irish Sea. The other thing, of course, there are issues concerning what happened over the funeral with Sinn Féin and the fact that a funeral apparently breached COVID rules and nothing was done to deal with that. But it's Brexit has given the unionists the excuse to really come out on the streets to express their deep, deep concern about what's happened. Northern Ireland is always a tinder keg. It's always likely to go up. And Brexit is essentially what's the trigger for setting that all up and for it to inflame the situation. And what you need is careful, careful political management. One of the great sadnesses of what's happened recently is that Julian Smith, who was Secretary of State for Northern Ireland, was very widely respected on both sides. He was then removed by Boris Johnson and replaced by Brandon Lewis, who doesn't have the same level of respect. And one of the things that could be done is to try and get Julian Smith back to try and calm things in Northern Ireland, because the risk is that things could get a whole lot worse, bearing in mind that, of course, we haven't even got to the marching season yet.
If historians, modern British historians, are looking back on that EU trade and cooperation agreement signed in haste at the end of December 2020. Really tightrope stuff. But do you think historians are going to say, look, that agreement should never have been signed? That the people who said it would lead to troubles in Northern Ireland again are right?
I think historians will look back and say it was good that there was an agreement. I think historians will also say the bigger problem actually is with the withdrawal agreement, the divorce text that had been signed a year before, because the Northern Ireland Protocol was always, we always knew that there would be problems, because the moment you put a border somewhere, borders and Northern Ireland are really tense issues. And the moment you put the border down the Irish Sea, the east-west border, that was going to offend the unionists. If you put a border north-south, it would offend the nationalists. And the government has opted to offend the unionists. And that's what we're seeing being played out on the streets of Belfast at the moment.
One element of Brexit that is trumpeted as a success by Boris Johnson's government is COVID vaccination programme. We seem to be, in terms of numbers, well ahead of our counterparts in Europe and elsewhere. That's led to friction. That's led to the EU triggering parts of the withdrawal agreement and then relinquishing that and saying, no, we shouldn't have done. But it's become almost a battle of minds, hasn't it? You know, who's up, who's down in terms of numbers of vaccinations. And it shows we Brits are made of something else. British exceptionalism.
That's true, and it's absolutely true that the AstraZeneca vaccine was developed in Oxford, and it shows that we had a very effective purchasing policy of vaccinations. What we're also seeing now is, of course, the numbers of vaccinations in Europe are beginning to catch up, and it's likely by the summer that certainly with the big states that the difference in levels of vaccination between the UK and the rest of Europe are not so great. I think on the political level, there are two things. One, the accidental almost triggering of Article 16, the safeguard clause, which the EU did apparently by accident, was a disaster. And the UK has maximised the benefit that they've got from that very clumsy handling of the situation. Secondly, it's made life very difficult for Remainers, because what we're seeing is that the EU has not covered itself in glory in managing COVID, has not covered itself in glory in managing the vaccine programme. And so it's suddenly undermined arguments for Remainers to say, isn't the EU a marvellous organisation? It has shown itself to be cumbersome and clunky and not as responsive and light touch as the UK government has been. And so what is interesting is that although the research still shows that there is quite a strong Leave-Remain identity divide in the United Kingdom, the fact is what political party is at the moment advocating Remain? All of this has gone, and the vaccine crisis, the vaccine problems, has just shown the EU to be weak. It's unfortunate because one of the other things that we have learnt from the whole Brexit process is what the EU is very good at is highly technical things, VAT, customs clearance, stuff that we never even noticed or knew about. You never looked under the bonnet of these things because it always worked very well. That sort of thing has worked excellently as far as the EU is concerned, highly technical stuff. What hasn't worked is stuff which requires imagination, breadth, and actually some risk-taking, and that's where the vaccine policy has kicked in.
So 100 days since the UK Brexited the EU. Not just a verdict, but a score. Journalists like scores, don't we? Sort of, you know, how many would you give that rushed deal at the end of December?
I think I would say I would give it 5 out of 10. In respect of goods, it is good. In respect of services, mobility, financial services, it's very poor. But it is worth bearing in mind that the TCA, the Trade and Cooperation Agreement, has space for the deal to be improved. But that does require goodwill on both sides. It can be done through the Partnership Council, which is the body, the political body, which will replace the essentially Council of Ministers type meeting. So it can be done by the Partnership Council. And there is provision in particular areas like services for a better arrangement. But that requires goodwill on both sides. And the big problem is at the moment is the lack of trust. There is a lack of trust on the EU side with Boris Johnson and his government, not least because the EU, you'll recall, has already brought legal proceedings against the UK government or started legal proceedings against the UK government for its breaches of the Northern Ireland Protocol by unilaterally extending the grace periods. And the EU is saying, we don't trust you, the UK. And there's another thing that's gone badly wrong. It might seem small, but it's got serious implications. And that is not giving the EU ambassador to the UK full ambassadorial status. 142 countries have given the EU representative full ambassadorial status. The UK has not, because the UK says the EU is not special. It's only like an international organisation. Quid pro quo is that the opposite number in Brussels, who's heading up UK Mission, which is replacing UK permanent representation, is not having access to any meetings in Brussels. And that's already limiting the UK's ability to actually do its job. And also none of the committees that the Trade and Cooperation Agreement has set up have been actually established. And so there is no ongoing dialogue between civil servants over technical matters to get things working better. And this is really problematic for the UK and for the EU. And remember, too, that the TCA is still only a provisional agreement. The European Parliament hasn't approved the TCA. And if relationships sour further, there is a chance that the European Parliament may well say no, and then we're in real trouble.
So it's what Dennis McShane, the former politician, called Brexit eternity, from here to Brexit eternity. We'll never stop these disputes and the to-ing and fro-ing to actually get a level playing field, a proper relationship going. There's going to be dispute after dispute and ongoing.
Absolutely, because at the moment it's in Boris Johnson's calculated self-interest to keep these fires alive, because there is really very little agreement still about the end point of Brexit. And so it's good to, from his point of view, from all of his polling, it shows that the one thing that keeps Brexiters together is an anti-EU sentiment. And so it's good from his point of view and Lord Frost's point of view not to have a cooperative, tranquil and frankly boring relationship. It's easier to carry on stoking the flames and keep saying, look, this is the EU's fault. And so this is why we're going to hear this mudslinging going on constantly. The only positives that we've seen so far is that in order to stop the vaccine war from escalating, Boris Johnson sent Tim Barrow to Brussels and not David Frost. And Tim Barrow is a diplomat, and he clearly was able to apply his balm that Lord Frost has not been able to do.
So 100 days since we left the EU. 5 out of 10, it's not a bad score, but the impact on the British economy is being masked by COVID, so we still really don't know.
We don't know, but what we do know is we're going to carry on talking about Brexit because it is the most significant political event since the Second World War for the United Kingdom and for its economy. COVID, of course, is dramatic at a social health level, but economically, ultimately, we may well see a bounce back. But we have engaged in a process of significant rupture with our nearest trading partner, and there will be consequences for years to come.
LawPod UK is presented by Rosalind English and is produced by One Crown Office Row. For more editions of LawPod UK, you can subscribe to the podcast and recommend us to a friend.